Blog Talk Radio. Welcome all truth seekers from across the globe. This is Reverend Karen L. Heathley from the Spiritual Path Church of Newcastle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Our Truth Seeker show covers a variety of subjects, from angels to afterlife communication, to parapsychology, to spiritualism, to near-death experiences, to meditation, and a number of other truth-seeking topics. We are happy you have chosen to join us for this episode and hope you find it informative and enjoyable. After our chat tonight, we will be taking calls. Here is our number to call in on. Now get a piece of paper and a pencil because this is going to be a fantastic show. 657-383-0416. I'm going to repeat that again. 657-383-0416. And guess what? We even have a chat box open tonight. How lucky are we? Our guest tonight is N. Rowley Haggerty. He has been researching historic spiritualism and mediumship since 1986 and has concentrated on the physical phenomena attending the great mediums who manifested their gifts within what he refers to as the Century of Wonders between 1848 and 1948. According to him, this century produced mind-staggering manifestations witnessed on numerous occasions by individuals whose integrity would be an insult to question. We have been given countless instances of positive proof of not only life after death, but direct communication by spirits. It is also a sad fact that the world in general is worldly, unaware of these titanic events, which, if understood, will change the course of human thinking. He has produced 5 books, and we're going to talk to him tonight about these books, because let me tell you, people, they're fascinating. Hi, Rowley, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's definitely a pleasure. Well, I guess the first question I want to ask you is, how did you get involved in all this? Because the normal individual doesn't do the things that you have done and research this phenomena.
I know. Well, I was a professional musician in Philadelphia, New Jersey, and Delaware. My hometown was Philadelphia. I was signed to an agency, and I had every intention of going all the way in the music business, performing musician, and at my peak, which is right near 1985-86, my fiance, her name was Diane Rossell, was struck down by leukemia. And this drama went on for 6 months. She was at Johns Hopkins Hospital. 2 weeks before her passing, she called me to the side of the bed, and she said, "I have something to tell you." And by this point, she had lost all of her hair, you know, radiation and all that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
She says to me, she goes, "Bradley's here." And I had already known that Bradley was her son who had passed away when he was 2 years old, long before I knew her, mm-hmm. of asthma. But I just instinctively turned around in the hospital room to look. I was so shocked by what she said. "Bradley's here." And I turned back and looked at her, and she said, "He's here, he's standing behind you." And I said, "Oh." And she said, "He's preparing me to come with him because I'm not going to make it through this." So I sat stunned. And sure enough, she did pass away, but that was enough to turn me around and devote my life to research involving life after death, spirit communication and mediumship, because I really, after a devastating loss, a lot of people start their search after loss. A lot of people don't. They carry the weight on their shoulders all their life. But for me, I have a searching nature, and I said I have no answers. I was brought up Roman Catholic in private schools, but I had no answer. How could this person have just disappeared like a puff of smoke? This person I once knew is gone. Where can she be? So that's what started me, and I announced to the people in Philadelphia, to their shock and dismay, that I was leaving music, and I was going on another mission. I didn't say what it was. So I came back to upstate New York. My parents have a big old pre-Civil War house here. I moved in. I moved up to the attic in one of the gables, started doing my research. I just started reading everything I could get my hands on about life after death, spirits. And now here we have 30 years later. Of course, I'm not living home.
Yeah.
I've since got married and moved on with my life. But 30 years later, and about 600 books in my library, all rare, 5 books produced from that. And here I sit talking to you.
It's wonderful. And the books you've done. You want to talk a little bit about your first book and tell the audience about that, please?
During my research, I couldn't find anything that could alleviate the grief I was having. I was so torn up by the loss of this girl. She was only 29. I just couldn't seem to find the answer. I read a lot of books. Then one day my brother, who lived in San Diego, called me up and said he had gone to a yard sale and he found a book. It was called, he told it to me over the phone. I said, read the title. He said it's called The Dead Have Never Died. It's by Edward C. Randall. And I said, what's the copyright? He said, 1916.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, send it to me. He sent me the book, and I could tell by the first page, this was what I was looking for. It was about the medium Emily S. French, who lived in Rochester and was born with a gift of mediumship from a very early age. She could sit down and put a pencil in each hand and write different messages on 2 different pieces of paper from spirits. And luckily for her, her parents embellished her gifts instead of consigning her to a mental institution, mm-hmm. which I'm sure many of them ended up in. But Emily, in her presence, eventually, she had the gift of independent voice. To me, it is probably the highest and most evidential form of mediumship there is. That is, apart from the medium, and in her case, manifesting about 2 feet above her head, the spirit voices would talk right out of the thin air and address the sitters. And they would answer questions, which proved they could hear besides speak. So this is the glorious gift of independent voice. The famous lawyer, Edward C. Randall, from Buffalo, was approached by his associates in 1890. And they said to him, Edward, because Edward was a very, very good trial lawyer, one of the best. They approached him and they said, Edward, we want you to travel to Rochester and expose this person. Her name is Mrs. French. She's the cleverest fraud in America and a magician of the highest class. So Randall went off to Rochester and went to 227 Tremont Street, is where Emily French lived, knocked on the door, and he was met by 2 men who of national reputation were there. It is believed by the great-great-grandson of Emily French that it was Andrew Carnegie and Ernest Tubbs. We all know who Andrew Carnegie certainly is,
yes.
But Ernest Tubbs was the inspector of the Erie Canal, and they were both well-known spiritualists. So Randall, who went to the house to expose her, can you imagine that, standing there, and there's Andrew Carnegie standing there? He says, Mr. Randall, what are you doing here? And so Randall wasn't about to say, I'm here to expose Mrs. French. He had never even met her. Out steps Mrs. French. She's a frail, beautiful little gray-haired woman. At that time, she was 67 years old, which back then was quite old. And she was extremely deaf. She could hardly hear. She had a disease when she was 10 years old, and it destroyed her hearing. Anyways, Carnegie or Ernest Tubbs, one of them says, we're about to have a seance. Why don't you join us? So Randall wasn't expecting this. Up they go to the seance room. During the seance, there's voices and whispers coming from all different parts of the room. Some of them male voices, female voices. Randall said, it's just too impossible to be true. He said, it must be ventriloquism. But then how could someone, a ventriloquist works in the light and uses diversion.
Mm-hmm.
And here's Mrs. French, an old lady, and yet there's male voices speaking. One of the sitters said, it's my father speaking. Make a long story short, Randall didn't believe it, but afterwards asked Mrs. French, would you mind coming to my house in Buffalo and under my conditions and my experiments, could test your mediumship? Mrs. French said, sure. So off she went. And to put it shortly, 22 consecutive years they sat. Randall, one of the first voices to come through was his own father, who said, I'm going to tell you what happened the day I died. So there's no question about who's talking. Randall eventually had stenographers come into the room and take down in rapid fire what the spirits were saying, because Randall, his intentions were always good. So he drew to the circle spirits of a higher order who wanted to speak.
Yes.
So my first book, The French Revelation, is the entire collected works of the seance notes between Randall and French and the spirits. And I am telling you, I would consider this my greatest work because of the dialogue between Randall and the spirits. He asked questions about everything. And one of my favorite things is the spirits describing what happened the second that they died. I love that kind of thing. They tell 1 minute they're in the physical world and 1 second later they're in another dimension. So
could you talk a little bit about that, Riley, so our listeners would know about that?
About what?
How they described what it was like after they passed over. I mean, 1 minute they're here in the physical, then they're in the spiritual world the next.
Because death is instantaneous. You know, it's the physical pain before death that everybody fears, but the death experience itself is one eye blink, and
right.
You're in another world.
You are. Mm-hmm.
A lot of spirits, for one spirit says, they said, the last thing I remember was falling. And then the next thing, you know, they saw the floor coming towards them as they were falling. They were probably having a heart attack. And she said, the next thing I remember, I woke up and I was in my grandmother's arms in the spirit world. Her grandmother who had passed away years and years before. My grandmother was holding me in my arm, in her arm, she says, and she was patting my head, saying, it's okay. You crossed the border. You made it into the spirit world. But in the French Revelation, there's numerous
accounts,
instances,
yes,
of spirits dying and saying what they saw. So it's very enthralling. There's a lot
it
to
is.
Read.
And then you actually have a chapter dedicated to her in your last book, right? That talks about a Civil War soldier talking about his death experience. Remember
it's astounding.
That? Yeah,
I certainly do.
Would you like?
Spirit,
I thought that was fantastic. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
Well, he was at Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the Union. He was a Union Army colonel, and he said they sat there and And everybody was scared because they knew sooner or later the orders would come to charge up the hill. And a lot of them looked at one another and thought, this is most likely going to be the end. But this spirit goes on to say that, you know, they were fearless because they'd grown accustomed to war and blood and savagery. So they were basically fearless. Up they charged up the hill. And the soldier, I'm not going to tell you the whole thing because
That's fine.
It'd be too long. And I'd rather have people go out and buy the book.
Well, I understand that. Just give him a little bit of that.
He goes up the hill with all the soldiers. The next thing he knew, he said he's standing there. And the bullets are passing by, the cannon fire. And he can hear the war going on, raging. And yet, he looks down and he sees his body down below, on the ground. He says, I now know that I was shot. He looked around, and there was, he said, several, probably hundreds of soldiers in the same position. They're standing there in a bewildered state, looking down at their bodies, prostrate on the ground, blown to pieces or shot. And he said they all stood there in fear and silence, because they knew something was desperately wrong. And they could see a red cloud of mist. He said they finally realized that this is the red mist of war, you know, and violence.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody stood there not knowing what to do. Can you imagine that? They've all been shot. They're standing there, not even realizing there's a spirit world. He said slowly from the distance, a light started to shine. And this immense concourse of spirits started walking towards them. And there was one leader who stepped out and said, the war is over. The war is over for you. You've now entered the spirit world. And a lot of the soldiers, of course, were so sorrowful to not see their families again that it was quite a mighty scene. But he explains it much more dramatically than what I'm saying.
Yeah, there's more
but
to it.
Still,
but like
it's
you
quite
said,
stunning.
People have to go buy the book and read it because it's just phenomenal. It is. It is. And I noticed you talked about you in one of the books because I've read them. You talked about you like spontaneous seances. Would that be correct, Riley? The way I put that, something about having a spontaneous seance.
Well. With the mediums in my books, you mean?
Well, you said something was about. I was going to ask you about that. About having is there something that just comes about? I think it came about with the one gentleman
Blake?
In the book, the Farmer Rowley. I think that was who it was.
Which one was it?
Farmer Rowley. I think that's who it was.
Oh, Farmer Rowley. Correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, he. He was from Ohio. He was a very powerful materialization medium, James Riley.
Okay.
And he would give seances out on hunting trips in the woods. He would just, you could set up a tent. I mean, this is beyond the imagination of most people. I mean, these things are incredible to talk about. But Riley could go out into the woods with his hunting friends. He could set up a tent, and he could go in the tent and go in trance, and out would step a spirit out of the tent.
Mm-hmm.
It seems too incredible to be true, but Farmer Riley was very, very well documented. Actually, from Michigan, he did a materialization seance spontaneously in front of. A gathering of 500 people at a spiritualist conference. I forget what state it is at the odd moment. But that's one of the first times I've ever heard of a medium under that pressure going into the cabinet in front of that many people. And outstepped a well-known individual, and the audience went berserk. I can't even imagine that situation of... Can you imagine that in front of 400 people?
No, I can't. No, It's just unbelievable.
A materialized spirit walking out. I mean, that's a very rare occurrence. You know, the Bang Sisters, who we'll get to, they did live demonstrations too.
I know.
And in my first book, The French Revelation, in the back, in the appendices, there's a very important section called the Spirit Zone of the Northeast.
I was just going to
talk
about that.
Over the course of many years, I've realized that the most powerful and greatest physical mediums were all from around the Great Lake regions.
Yes.
And this area of the United States, and the spirits say it's because of the cool, crisp, dry atmosphere and the powerful amount of electricity coming from the Great Lakes. And also you have Niagara Falls. You know, Buffalo was a hotbed of psychic activity, producing the Davenport brothers, for one thing. So I noticed that from the very start of my research. One after the other were all from around the Great Lakes. And then eventually the list started getting longer and longer and longer, to the point where almost all of the great mediums were from the same geographical area. And I thought that was pretty astounding.
It is.
And I finally found, through a book called Glimpses of the Next State, 1909, by Admiral Osborne Moore, he specifically asked the spirit about that, and they talk about that, the Northeast, with its crisp electrical conditions conducive to physical phenomena. So, who knows what's going to be coming next from this area?
I don't know. I have that book by him. That's a good book. That is a good book, by the way.
You know, Lilydale is just south of Buffalo.
Right.
All of the mediums, I'm telling you, are all from around that region. It's really fascinating. But that's part of the French Revelation. And book number two, if you want to get involved with that,
I have them all here.
Sensational.
Yep.
Go ahead.
The Bang Sisters. Yes.
Bang Sisters, yep.
I love them. Every time I go to Lilydale, I walk past their house.
Library Street.
Yes. In that window, when you look at that house, you know, they say they were up in that window. Now, is that correct or not? That's what I've been told. I don't know. But that one window facing out, that was where some of the seances were.
Well, I don't know exactly where they held their seances. I found their home at Camp Chesterfield, Indiana, too, where they lived.
Oh, did you? Okay.
For the great enthusiasts of the Bang Sisters, and we'll get to what they did.
Okay.
It's worth the trip to go to Chesterfield, Indiana, to see the Hett Art, the Memorial Art Gallery, H-E-T-T, the Hett Memorial Art Gallery. It's got 26 displayed Bang Sisters portraits. But the Bang Sisters, you want to talk about that right now?
I do, whatever you want. It's your show.
The Bang Sisters reside in Chicago. They were May and Elizabeth. Liz was born in 1859, and May was born in 1862. Once again, they were mediums from birth, and they had sympathetic parents who helped them to establish the power of their mediumship. And from a very early age, things would move about the house, and noises, and in their case, coal would be somehow thrown into the house onto the floor. Don't ask me how or why it was coal, but it was. Anyways, after a while, they developed the girls over, you know, years and years of their childhood. Eventually, what they became famous for was spirit-precipitated portraits.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days, they would take a blank canvas and nail it into a box, put it off into a corner in a curtained off alcove, and it would take days, hours to precipitate a portrait. As time moved on, they could precipitate portraits in minutes. Now, this is one of the most evidential, truly mind-boggling things I have ever heard of myself. I consider their phenomenon one of the wonders of the world. A sitter could go to an art store and buy a blank canvas. Your average canvas would be 20 by 30 or whatever. Bring it to the Bang Sisters' house, or you could go to the Bang Sisters' house on Adams Street in Chicago. And in a room off of the living room, you could pick your own canvas. They had several different sizes and shapes, and a lot of people would bring their own blank canvas, and they would mark the canvas so the Bang Sisters, it would prove afterwards that Bang Sisters didn't duplicate the canvas. This is to avoid fraud. But in essence, you bring a blank canvas. There'd be a small table set up in front of a window with three chairs, two on the side and one on the end. And they would take the canvas and lean it up against the window. They would draw the curtains down the sides so as the only light coming through would be through the canvas. And there in front of the astonished sitter, slowly, a spirit-precipitated portrait would manifest. A lot of times, the spirit artist would do preliminary drawings first, so you'd have somewhat of a face, eyes, nose, whatever, would come onto the canvas and then disappear. Or a hair and part of the bust and then disappear. And then slowly, the lifelike image of that person would be there in front of the sitter, complete and total. I can't even imagine witnessing this. Can you?
No. Did they have painter for the spirit world to use? I'm just curious about that.
In the early days, they did. They put paint or ink.
Okay.
Little bottles down on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, that went away, and there was nothing.
Really?
And the spirits.
Okay.
Said they utilized anything they could in nature. I've seen probably 40 of these portraits up close. And even now, they're 110, 115 years old. They look as fresh and lifelike as if they were done yesterday. To the average person, it would look like it was somewhat airbrushed. It has this smooth, otherworldly texture about it. You can't put it into words. You have to see the portraits. There's several of them in my book, Portraits from Beyond.
I'm looking at it now. There are, yes.
And the only thing that's ever been said that makes any sense is that the material used by the spirits resembles the fine dust of a butterfly's wings. And if you look at these portraits up close, they're not paints, they're not pastels, they're not charcoal, they're not crayon, they're not ink. To this day, no scientist has ever been able to say exactly what it is. And I find that to be quite wonderful. Now, in 1909, the Bang Sisters did a live demonstration at Camp Chesterfield in the auditorium. Probably 400 or 500 people, maybe more. A blank canvas was set up on stage on an easel. The canvas was picked by a select committee beforehand. Each person walking into the auditorium would take a ticket stub, and on the end of the stub was a number. The person at the door would take the ticket, they'd tear off the end and throw it into a barrel. So you had 400 or 500 stubs of tickets in that barrel. So one of the committee members stood up, they shook the barrel and he reached in his hand and he called out the number. And then they asked who in the audience had that number. And it was the Alfreds, Mr. and Mrs. Alfred. they said, would you please stand up and come up to the stage? So up they went, and they sat down, you know, 10 feet from the canvas, which was just sitting on an easel in the middle of the stage. Out walks the Bang Sisters. They take their seats. And then they just bowed their heads in just meditative silence.
Mm-hmm.
So there is the situation with the Alfreds sitting there. And there's the Bang Sisters, and there's the easel, and there's 400 people, 400 or 500 people sitting there in silence. You can just imagine, can you imagine the electricity in that room at that point?
No.
Suddenly, a mist goes across the canvas and disappears. The audience gasps. Then another swirl of color goes across the canvas and disappears. Then another one. Then two pairs of eyes come onto the canvas and disappear. At this point, you know, some people are standing up in the audience. Everybody's gasping. All of the eyes disappear. Slowly, the hair, shoulders, bust, his facial features of a young girl starts to appear onto the canvas. And then it disappears and then comes back. Clear and clear and clear and clear becomes this face now. Face, bust, shoulders. Eyes are closed. When the entire portrait's done, the eyes suddenly open, and the audience just burst into thunderous applause. After everybody calms down, Mr. Alfred, who was called to the stage, stands up, clearly shaken, and said, "My wife and I are not spiritualists. We came here out of curiosity, out of interest, and with an open mind." And he says, "That portrait is our daughter, Audrey. That is the exact likeness of our daughter. And she's wearing around her neck the very pendant that the wife was wearing underneath her shirt, her blouse, so no one could see it." How can any critic explain that one?
They can't.
How can anybody explain that? How can anybody say it's trickery?
No,
Bang Sisters, of course, were viciously attacked all the time by critics. And because back in the day, the conjurers and the magicians, they were like rock stars, you know. So here comes two women, of all things, who can do these wondrous portraits. So it drove the conjurers and the magicians crazy. So the conjurers tried everything they could to try to duplicate what the Bang Sisters did, but all kinds of devices, and they had people helping them. And but I still say, under the exact same conditions, show me anybody who's duplicated the Bang Sisters. There was two other mediums who lived in Lilydale called the Campbell Brothers.
Yeah, Campbell Brothers, right.
They were legitimate mediums who also did precipitated portraits that I know of. But they were friends, and they were well-known mediums. But in the conjuring fraternity, the magicians, the Houdinis of the day, show me one who, under the same conditions, duplicated the Bang Sisters' portraits. I don't believe you'll find anyone.
No, you won't.
A lot of the biggest critics of the Bang Sisters never took the time to sit with the Bang Sisters. And that's the case of a lot of the critics in the scientific community back in the last century. They never took the time to actually sit. Criticize, but not sit with the
mm-hmm.
mediums. So did you find that fascinating, the Bang Sisters?
I found it fascinating. Oh, there are some parts of the inner precipitator pain when something, the paint, that the sometimes the image would change or something would be materialize. You know what I'm talking about? There was something that I did read about that. I've heard that the picture sometimes would change.
Well, in the case of that very one, Audrey Alfred, in my book, there's a before and after picture
That's what, yeah.
Of
yes.
The spirits took away the pendant.
Right.
Several years later, one of the grandchildren of the Alfords donated the portrait back to Camp Chesterfield.
Okay.
And the pendant was missing. The spirits dematerialized the pendant around Audrey, the spirit Audrey's, the necklace she was wearing, because
mm-hmm.
that was intended only for the mother. And a lot of times, spirits will, or the portraits would be taken home by people, and the portrait would change all the time. You know, the eyes would be closed,
yes,
and then open. Different kinds, different parts of their clothing would change, and then some of the portraits were life size. They're massive canvases. I saw one of Queen Elizabeth at Camp Chesterfield. It was 6 feet high. Can you imagine that? Seeing that in
mm-hmm.
front of you, a precipitated portrait 6 feet high.
I can't. I'm gonna have to go there and check those paintings out.
You should
definitely. No, I want to. Also with the Bank Sisters, they did slate writing too, right, Rally? They did some slate writing.
They did slate writing. They, you know, the old-fashioned hinged slates that you would use way back in the old school days.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of little students in the turn of the century would had slates that would bring to school. You could open and close them because they're hinged. The Bang Sisters were two of the finest mediums for independent writing in the world, as far as I'm concerned. A sitter could bring their own slates. And the Bangs would always request that you bring blank sheets of paper and have questions in your mind that you wanted answered by the spirits. And they could either take the paper themselves, sometimes 4 or 5 sheets of paper, and put them between the slates and close the slates and then wrap it up and then either place their hand on top of that or not even touch the slates at all. And 4 or 5 sheets of paper completely covered in the very answers to the questions the person had beforehand. Or in some cases, the blank slates would just be sitting there. They would close them up. A tiny piece of chalk would be placed in between the slates. They would bind them with heavy rubber band or cord of some kind. The Bang Sisters never touching the slates. And the sitter would open them up, and then there would be the spirit message from their loved one. So I have a book called Marguerite Hunter. The entire thing was written through the mediumship of Lizzie Bangs through independent writing. The entire book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you don't see it anymore now. I know of no one who's demonstrating independent writing. I know of no one who's doing precipitated portraits. Tell you the truth, I know of no one that's doing really anything. That these mediums in my books did, actually. Times have certainly changed. Have you yourself sat with any physical mediums?
Yes, I did. But it sure wasn't the way you described it in your books. That's the truth. And people were more dedicated then. They were, you know, spirits, the mediums were more dedicated to work with the spirit world. They were.
Well, if you think about it, I've been thinking about this a long time. One of the first things that hits me is, like you said in the beginning, you were quoting me, how woefully unaware people are of the great wonders that took place. I mean, wonders upon wonders in the presence of these great mediums. And how over time it was all just swept under the carpet. And I blame I blame a lot of I blame the church, the scientific community. You know, they wanted nothing to do with these things, especially the church. They just swept it under the carpet. Whereas all religions in general, so-called, the beginnings of which are usually a mortal man communicating with the spirit. That's
mm-hmm.
usually how religions begin.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the denial of the Orthodox Church about these spiritual matters is shocking. When the Bible itself, from cover to cover, is filled with spirit phenomena. Very similar, in some cases, to the very stuff I write about. And yet, they deny the reality of spirit communication. It's a funny thing. But back then, as you were saying, there was no distractions.
Mm-hmm.
The air was cleaner. The water was cleaner. The food was organic. And they had the privacy of their home circle. In a lot of families, it was very, very spiritual, almost religious. The family gathering every week to communicate with their ancestors. There was no Facebook. There was no cell phone towers. You know, there was none of this nonsense that you have now. And now the airwaves are filled with cell phone vibrations and electrical wires. And I don't really know. I think it's the combination of how the world has become more material, certainly more greedy, and the concentration it takes and dedication to develop physical phenomena. It takes almost everything you have. And people don't have the time for that anymore, it seems like. They want everything quick.
Yeah,
they want to press the enter button and have spirits materialize.
Right.
It takes years and years and years to develop. But then they had the time and the patience. They did not have the distractions. And now everything's a distraction, it seems like. Like we were talking about earlier, what kind
That's
of medium
true.
Would want to come out now? You never know if someone's tape recording you, or you don't know if they're going to take what you've said out of context, or you could be on the cover of some magazine, or you could be on YouTube. You know, I wouldn't blame any mediums for being private now if they had physical manifestations.
Well,
you know what I'm saying? Why would they want to
yeah.
be subject to the media?
Mm-hmm. I agree. I understand.
It's all media now, so... The breakdown of the home circle, the circle is where it starts. You have to have people that are dedicated who say, I'm not giving up no matter how many years it takes, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sign on and stay with it. Believe me, for being in the music business, I've seen it all. Everybody's always cool in the beginning. Oh, you can trust me. Don't worry about me. I'll be fine. I'll hang in there. I'll be a dedicated member. Don't worry about me. Right. 1 year down the line, out they go. My wife and I started with 13 members in our circle. Every one of them said, don't worry about me. I'm in it for the long run. The spirits, every single one of them dropped out.
Mm.
You know, over the course of, you know, you put 5 years under your belt, that's a long time. Then you're going to find
it
out
is.
Who the players are. Because if you
yeah.
can handle 5 years of nothing and still stay there, then you know who's on board. That's what it takes with spirits. And they're
it
not
does.
Going to give in. They're just not. I just think they've raised the bar. That's the feeling I have. Because the same natural laws are in effect now that have always been immutable, unchangeable. And I think it's a human issue. I don't think it's a spirit issue. I think it's a human one. What do you think?
I think so. I think you have to, like you said, go for the long haul and be dedicated to the spirit world, and they will reward you at the end if there's some type of dedication there. They will. But like you said, people don't want to do that.
I know. A lot of this is hard to explain. You know, it's hard to.
I know.
I'm trying to imagine your listeners sitting there saying, "What is he talking about?"
I know.
It just takes. You know, it's hard to explain all this in an hour. You know, an hour and a half.
It is.
You have to just trust me, and like buy one of these books. You know, I don't care about the money. Just buy one of these books and read it yourself. I've taken years to put the evidence there so the reader can decide for themselves. But I just find it fascinating. My father, who's still alive, he's 95. He was a world history teacher for 49 years, just shy of 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I got the research bug from him. But I just love the musty old smelling bookstores and searching out for rare books. I just love that. You know, we don't find too many rare bookstores anymore, the old bookstores, because of the internet. But I just find it fascinating that all these wonderful things happened.
That's good. And I think you should tell the story about the book you found at Temple University.
Okay.
I thought that was great.
I went to Temple. Just one of those days where... Oh, I want to tell the audience, too, that my first book was written without the French Revolution, the first edition of which was 400 pages. The second edition, I edited out some of the more verbose stuff.
Okay.
But the first one was written without a computer. It was all done by an old, sort of crappy electric typewriter. And I wasn't a very good typist to boot. But my father lended me one of the typewriters from the school district.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a labor of love. You know, I mailed letters. I went to libraries, historical societies. I traveled to England. I just book hunted for just years. And it was so much fun. You know, I do not enjoy using a computer that much still. But we almost all have to at this point in our lives. We have to have a computer. But the first book, I really, really, it was a labor of love without the use of a computer. And to those of you who are interested in research, if you don't give up, then you will find gems along the way. It just happens if you don't give up. So here I was at Temple University. This was back, I don't know, the 90s maybe. Maybe 1990, 91. And I was just browsing through their bookstore. And if you've ever been to a college bookstore, back in the day, they're rather messy. You know, there's metal framed shelves and there's science books and everything's piled on top one another. And this is your classic college bookstore. And I was just looking through and just browsing along. The place was crowded. Everybody's talking. And I looked over and I saw an original copy of a book called The Voices. This is 1904, one of the greatest classics in spiritualism. It had the original dust cover. This book was by Admiral Osborne Moore, who was a vice admiral in the British Navy. And he had written this book about this incredible medium. Her name was Etta Wright. Believe it or not, born in my hometown, right here, Oswego, New York. That's where Etta Wright was born, one of the greatest trumpet mediums.
She was.
And it was $20. And I looked around. I almost just shrieked with joy. I couldn't believe what I was holding in my hand. And I just floated on air the rest of the day. About 3 weeks later, I had ordered a book called Man's Survival After Death by the Reverend Charles Tweedell. It was another great classic, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
I found a copy in a bookstore called the Middle Earth Bookstore in Michigan. So the book doesn't arrive. I called the book dealer, Paul Hudson his name was. I said, did you send that book? He said, yeah, I sent it 2 weeks ago. I said, uh-oh. So I called UPS, and they said, I don't know, you know. I don't know what happened. Uh-oh, so now the book's lost. This is a 1904 rare book. Rather expensive, too. So I called the dealer back, the same guy from the bookstore, and I said, can you go in search of another copy? He said, sure, because he had quite a strategy and incredible ability to find rare books. But a week later, he says, I found you another copy. I'll send it. So he sends it. It arrives. I open it up, and it's inscribed to none other than Etta Wright, the very medium we're just talking about. Here's her book, inscribed by the author to her, Charles Tweedell, inscribing it to Etta Wright. So
that's phenomenal. It is.
It was almost as if it had to happen, me losing the book the first time. Because here, now I have in my bookshelf the very copy of that book owned by one of the greatest mediums. But, like I said, if you don't give up, you find little gems along the way.
You do, and you certainly have. You certainly have.
I'm still going strong. I intend to keep going with the research. It's just so fascinating that I'm just trying to think about what I'm going to write about next, because I've written so much stuff now. I suppose we should get to Elizabeth Blake.
I had the book in my hand, Sal. This woman was phenomenal too. The trumpet. You want to explain that? Because I mean,
I will.
I've
I
seen
want to make
trumpets.
Sure if the readers have any chance, they're writing any of this down. The first book of mine is called The French Revelation.
Yeah. Okay.
And the second book we talked about was the Bang Sisters.
Right.
It's called Portraits from Beyond.
Beyond. Mm-hmm.
And the third book was called The Direct Voice, The Mediumship of Elizabeth Blake. This woman I would consider probably the greatest medium of all time, as far as evidence, as far as the number of years she sat, which was 60 years, from her humble little cottage on the Ohio River, on the banks of the Ohio River, in a little tiny hamlet of Bradwick. She was born in 1847, and when she was 7 years old, she discovered her mediumship. She was walking along the road one day, and she heard behind her, it was clickety-click-click, like someone was walking behind her, taking a stick and knocking it along the rungs of the fence. She turned around, she saw her spirit grandmother standing there. So she ran back home and she told her parents, and her parents said, oh, you're just imagining. You're imagining things. No, she says, no. She goes, I'm not imagining. I saw grandma. So one of the neighbors had the wherewithal to say, we should get a spiritual trumpet. It's like a light metal megaphone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a standard instrument used in spiritualism to amplify the voices, and in a genuine trumpet seance, the seance in a darkened room levitates up and whizzes around the room, and the spirit voices speak right through it. For some spirits, they need it to amplify the voice, and then sometimes they condense the energy inside of it. So the neighbor goes and gets the trumpet and brings it back. From the very first time Elizabeth Blake sat there, the spirit voice talked out of the trumpet. First time she sat by herself, 7 years old. Then she learned to love the spirit voices, who wouldn't? And then she put it aside because she grew older, she went to school, and then she got married. So about 15 years later, she met Zachariah Blake. Elizabeth's name was W-I-N-N, Elizabeth Wynn. So they got married and they moved to the tiny little cottage on the Ohio River in Bradwick, Ohio. And she, in the beginning, this is going to be hard to explain, but Mrs. Blake used a trumpet, but it was a few, took a your average size like baseball bat. It was that circumference. It was a long tube, probably about 2.5 feet long, and it was distended in the middle. It was light metal, and at the in the far ends, the it was about 2-inch circumference, 1.5-inch circumference on the ends. So a long metal tube. The distended part in the middle would allow for, you know, darkness. So she could sit in there in daylight and sit on the couch in her living room and hand this tube, actually they called it the horn, to a sitter. The sitter would place it to their ear, the tapered end to the ear, and Mrs. Blake would either hold the other end in her hand or she would listen, she would put the other end to her ear. Invariably, a spirit would start talking. This went on for 60 years. It was said that 200,000 people from all over the world traveled to her humble little cottage on the river, by the river. And in the book, it talks about her funeral, and it said there was limousines besides the humble Ford cars parked all up and down the road on the day they had her funeral. I have never heard of a medium who had such success with each and every sitting. It seems as if there was never a blank moment. And above all, I have never heard of a medium who could spontaneously just ask the sitters, is there anyone you wish to speak to? And if the sitter said, my Uncle George, invariably that spirit would start talking through the trumpet. It was almost as if she could dial up anybody in the spirit world.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, scientists all wondered how this is being done. And one went so far as to say that Mrs. Blake was talking, she was faking the spirit voices and talking through her ear.
Oh, my.
We'll always try something, but it was very hard to find material on Mrs. Blake. It took me a long time. Long, long time. But it's a little book. It's only, let's see how many pages it is. It's 115 pages, that's it. But it's filled with very interesting stuff, a lot of the seances. But there's very little written about her. But it's the only definitive book I know, in this case, about her. There was one other book called The Voice of the Dead by Ernest G. Williams. That was about Mrs. Blake. But half the book was about her, and the other half was about how to detect a fraudulent medium. So you read the book, Direct Voice?
Yeah, I looked at, yes. And you know what else? And then we'll have to tell our listeners that that she did everything in daylight, correct?
Daylight.
That's what
daylight. Well, she would hold some dark seances on the table.
Okay.
Without the trumpet. When requested.
I meant with the trumpet, but, yeah.
But most of her seances were sitting right there in the daylight. And, of course, in the early days, she would do 30 to 40 people a day.
Yeah.
Charge very little money.
Yeah, she didn't care about the money.
The older she got.
Right.
Pardon me?
Yeah,
what's
that's
that?
True. She wasn't about money with her.
No, it wasn't about money with Emily French either, my first book. She
no.
took no money.
She took no money.
She, you know, as if she had a very, it was a very hard life for her because she was, Mrs. French was deaf. She lost her husband in the Civil War, and she lost her son, Willie, when he was young. So she still gave to others, even though she had many, many hardships and heartbreaks. But the Direct Voice, book number 3, is a head knocker, too. Every one of them are designed to knock your head off. The last two books...
They're all head knockers.
Yes, every one of them. I think it's a compliment to your listeners and to anybody interested in the subject when I say to you that these books are a result of 30 years of research, not just go on the internet and pile together some stuff from Wikipedia. No, this is hardcore research over 3 decades. And I'm proud of that fact. And I took my time sifting through the evidence and compiling the eyewitness reports by people. You cannot question the integrity of the people that are reporting these things. I mean, if you question the integrity of these witnesses, then you might as well question everything, because doctors, lawyers, you name it, all walks of life, there's no reason for someone to make this stuff up. Anyways, the last two books are called Spectral Evidence, Mind-Blowing Wonders Within the Heyday of Historic Spiritualism. And there's a quote from Rosemary Ellen Guiley, she wrote the book Dream Messages from the Afterlife, Visits from the Dead. She says, "This book has the power to change your life, your views on the afterlife, and more importantly, how you are living your life now."
That was good. I know. I saw that.
But Spectral Evidence, Volume 1 and Volume 2. Volume 2 is coming out, like, it's already done being proofed. Now it's ready. It should be any day now. It'll be out. It is filled, both books, with chapter after chapter after chapter of the greatest mediums and the eyewitness accounts of what they did. And do you have Spectral Evidence 1?
Yes, I do, right in front of me. I read it back cover. I've read it, yes, it's phenomenal. The people in it are phenomenal.
Spectral number 2 is bigger. It's got more.
Well, I'll have
to
see.
To
give, I'll have to read that one, too. I'll have to buy it and read it,
pages.
I'm sure. But I mean, go
ahead.
I was just going to say, maybe you can give our listeners a little taste of who's in Spectral number 1. I'm not saying talk the whole, you want them to buy the book, but I mean, if you want to give them a little taste of who's in there.
Materialization medium, Robert Moore, also one of the greatest materialization mediums, Ethel Post Parrish. These are all the greatest mediums. George Valentine for trumpet voice, Emily French again, E.A. Macbeth, a whole thing about ectoplasm. Ann Kaiser, who was from Buffalo, the chapter about her is she had this incredible phenomenon called the solar plexus voice.
She
could just come and
Maurice.
Sit down,
mm-hmm.
come and sit down, and suddenly the spirit voices would start talking near and about the solar plexus area of her. You could be talking to her, and then another voice would break into the conversation. The solar plexus voice is truly astounding. Elizabeth Compton, one of the great mediums from Savannah, New York. In her case, she would go into the curtained-off cabinet, go into trance, and she would usually insist on being tied to the chair, and in some cases, thread actually put through the pierced holes of her ears and then put down to the floor and
mm-hmm.
wax seal the thread onto the floor so there'd be no question about her getting out of her chair or whatever. The spirits would materialize and walk out of the cabinet, the curtained off alcove. And then the investigator, his name was Colonel Henry Steele Olcott, go in, and Mrs. Compton would have been dematerialized. She's completely gone. Gone from her chair. No one in that cabinet. I've never heard of the medium dematerializing.
The medium. Mm-hmm.
Gone. Gone. Not gone. After the seance is done, go back into the cabinet, and there she is. Rematerialized with the thread still in her ears, the wax seal on the floor. And in her case, there's an incredible part of that chapter where it's called The Bride of Corinth. this little veiled spirit, like an angel with a wedding veil, walks out of the cabinet. And Henry Olcott had an actual weighing scale brought into the room. The spirit stepped up onto the scale and allowed the investigator to weigh her. Can you imagine that scene? And we also have everything. We have direct voice materializations.
Yeah,
everything.
You talk about the Davenport brothers. And that they were
Davenport brothers? Yeah.
Yes.
Cora Richmond. Cora Richmond was one of the great wonders of the age. This is the turn of the century time now, before the turn of the century and after, slightly. Cora Richmond, this is in edited form now. When a very young girl would go into trance and give great lectures. After a while, she went on to the speaking circuit and became, by the time she was 17, she was famous in the United States and in Europe. Essentially, she could stand in front of an audience, go into trance, stand up from her chair, walk to the microphone, or whatever it is. Probably back then there was no microphones, but give a beautiful invocation. And then the committee in the audience beforehand would choose a very difficult subject for her to address. Now, this is an uneducated girl of 17.
Yeah, right.
And in the book here, it's when she spoke in front of, it was some learned society in Chicago. The Theosophical Society. And they had given her what is the mind, its origin, its beginning, and its end. Can you imagine that? This is an uneducated 17-year-old girl.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And in the book is her thrilling discourse on the mind, the human mind. Now, can anybody tell me what critic can explain that? If that isn't a spirit who took over her body when she's in trance and gave that address, then what is it?
I agree.
No critic can get around that one.
No.
So that's in the book, too. And the Eddie brothers, the Davenport brothers, Farmer James Riley, he's got everything.
I like to say something about Farmer James Riley. He was very dedicated as being a spiritualist and to spiritualism.
Oh, certainly.
Don't you think? He was devout for that.
Oh, he stood his ground. He had high morals.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, he had these wonderful manifestations because he was such a pure soul himself. I want to say, too, that all these books, I do not consider myself an intellect. You know, I was a rock musician turned spiritualist. And I write for the common person. I don't write for scientists. Although scientists could assuredly read these books, they're not written in a way you can't understand them. I think I've laid it out very clearly, very simply, and I present all of the cases with all the evidence, so the reader can decide for themselves. You know, I don't write these books to convince anyone to be a spiritualist or believe anything. I'm not concerned about who believes what. I'm just laying the evidence out there and doing the historical research. That's all. I'm not really I'm not trying to talk anybody into, you know, promote their spiritual belief in any way. You got to decide for yourself.
Well, he didn't find you up. He didn't find you up with all the books.
So do your people have any questions?
I don't see any callers, so I guess it's you and I. But I do want to say in the when you talked about F. Post, she had something to do with Camp Silverbelt. Did I say that right? I was thinking.
Yeah, Camp Silverbelt. I went there.
Yeah, Camp Silverbelt. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she was also a great humanitarian, right?
Oh, certainly.
She was.
She was the president and founder of Camp Silverball. You know, she lived in Miami, and then she came to Pennsylvania to, she bought this beautiful tract of land as a humongous Mountain Springs hotel. The old-fashioned 200 or 300 room wooden hotel, the Mountain Springs. And that was in the 20s and 30s, in the true heyday of physical phenomena. And I went there like 5 years before the whole place was torn down. And now it's like an Applebee's.
Oh, jeez.
But they, inside the little Applebee's restaurant, they have a, they have pictures of Camp Silverbell. But she was one of the greatest materialization mediums. You know, she was one of the best. Do you have any questions yourself about any of this? I'd be glad to answer.
Well, no. I mean, we've talked, and I think you've answered a lot of my questions. And I just applaud you for being such a pioneer yourself and bringing all these fabulous stories and wonders to our listeners tonight.
It's my pleasure. It really is. I'm glad we hooked up.
Well, I'm glad we did, too.
We did this.
I am.
Now, how often do you give your shows?
I do my shows once a month. I do it once a month. We have all different type of topics, and this will be archived. It'll be on iTunes and Stitcher, so people can listen to it. Maybe they didn't have time tonight to listen to us, but they'll be able to.
Do you do it right from your home?
Actually, I do it in my church.
Oh, that's nice.
I do it in my church.
And you're the pastor?
I am. Mm-hmm. I started the Spiritual Path Church here in Newcastle, Pennsylvania in 2008.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a spiritualist church, so-called? Or,
it is. It's a spiritualist church. Yes.
Do you have a good little following?
Yes, I do. I certainly do. I'm blessed.
Is it every Sunday, or what do you do
every
usually?
Sunday, we have service every Sunday at 11 o'clock. And in August, we're going to have the Tibetan monks here. They're going to come for 3 or 4 days.
We hosted them about 7, 8 years ago at our house right here in Oswego, Tibetan monks. Mm. And they did their little ceremonies, and it was really nice.
It is nice.
It was a nice experience.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways.
So, well, I certainly am so overjoyed that we finally met and I read these books, and I'm just in awe and wonder of all the research you have done. I mean, you did this tirelessly, really. You ought to be commended, really.
Oh, that's very, very nice. I do it to help humanity. I just, because they're important. They're important to know that a lot of these mediums were selfless, wonderful human beings that were trying to just spread truth, you know, and they gave of themselves.
They did, and tirelessly.
The funny thing is that I have a great respect for women, and three of these books are about women. And I think in this day and age, it says something. You know, I'm very proud and happy about that, you know, that they're women mediums, and more women should know that, what they did.
Oh, you know what? I think we do have a call. Hold on a second here. See, hold on. Welcome. May we have a first name? Hi, may we have a first name?
Yes, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are y'all?
Good. Would you like to talk to our guest tonight, Raleigh?
Sure, yes.
Okay. Well, what question do you have for him?
I guess just what comes through as far as finances,
No, we're not doing readings, though. This is not about readings.
No,
we're not doing readings
tonight.
Okay.
Then I don't have a question, though.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening and calling in.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay, Riley. Well, I think that's about it. And thank you very much again. And I hope our paths cross someday. I really do.
Oh, I'm sure. You're not very far away, you know.
No, I'm not. No.
Well,
I hope
you keep in touch with me. Maybe we'll hook up and we'll do a little lecture sometime there, or whatever.
Yeah.
This is the start of a good thing.
Yeah, you can actually come down to the church sometime and do some speaking engagements if you want. I would be happy to have you. Happy to host you.
Yeah, and my wife's a fabulous clairvoyant.
Oh, that's good.
Very, very evidential. You know, I wouldn't settle for anything less, believe me.
Sure.
You know how I am. But she's a very, very powerful clairvoyant, and she has numerous clients, and she's knocking it out of the ballpark. She's really doing an incredible job. But we'll arrange that sometime, too.
Okay. If you want to look...
All right, my friend.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. I just wanted to say thank you for having me. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Okay.
I want to thank all the truth seekers for listening tonight. Until we meet again, may you be the light that helps others see.